welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited today to talk to special guest Jose Salazar. You know, when your name is on your own restaurant, you know you've made it in Cincinnati. And so I just think we're going to have a really good conversation. You know Jose Salazar from Salazar's, Mita's, Goose and Elder. And then this week, the Inquirer and others have been writing about his new bodega in Columbia, Tusculum, Day Lily. So I want to hear all about that. I mean, I read those stories and was like, I wish that was in my neighborhood. So
what's a bodega?
I think we should ask him.
I think we should. It's just not random. We're talking to Jose Salazar. He's opening up his fourth location, which is pretty significant, I think, that, you know, especially it's tough now to operate a restaurant that's been running for a while with all the challenges with finding workers, but to open a new place kind of in the tail end of, well, I hope is the tail end of the pandemic, but still, there's just, I think it's a gutsy move.
So I think this is a good opening to say a little bit in passing. That's my co-host, Burl Love. A lot of you guys have been asking me on social media, what are you going to do about the podcast? We did. I think I lost Jason Williams to sports, but sports people think they gained Jason Williams. So he's moved over to the sports side of reporting. And you know what? You can find him on the Bengals podcast. But Burl is going to kindly stay with me every week. We're going to keep this podcast going. It's honestly, I've said this before, one of my favorite parts of the week. Get to talk to lots of interesting people.
Well, I'm thrilled, you know, that because I know you guys did a national search to find Jason's replacement. It was super competitive, but somehow I managed to, you know, scrap in here. And no, I'm kidding. I'm looking forward to this. I think I've enjoyed co-host or guest hosting when either you or Jason have been out. I look back and I think I've done at least 10, which seems crazy.
Well, both of us when we go on vacation.
Exactly. So, I think this is going to be fun. And I think, I'm enjoying hanging out with producer Phil on the ones and twos, which I don't even know what that means. Jason used to say that. So I figured we need to say, oh, and there's producer Phil on the ones and twos. I think this is going to be fun. I want to, because I can't leave well enough alone. I've been talking to you about all these like ideas, maybe featuring a listener question, kind of giving people the opportunity to, you know, ask us anything and we'll do our best to answer it, whether it's, you know, tapping into your expertise of all things Cincinnati, especially how the city operates or, you know, why the Enquirer does the things it does, or even just, you know, random questions might be fun too. So let's make that call out official. If you're listening and you want to throw us a question, you can tweet at both of us or either of us. I'm at Burl Love. That's a really tough one there. And are you at
Sharon Coolidge?
At Sharon, even though everybody calls you Sherry, you are at Sharon Coolidge.
I know. Fun fact, my sister-in-law is also Sherry. And so I always had my byline as my real name, Sharon. But when my brother got married, there were two Sherry Turcos.
Oh, boy.
And so I was like, for my byline, I did keep, you know, all of the email and things away from her.
So your brother married someone who's named Sherry. The same as his sister.
Yes.
That's interesting. That does get confusing, I bet. Yeah. Well, so, are you good Sherry or bad Sherry?
Oh, everyone would say bad. 100%. Who's late? Who's on the phone for work while we're at family things? 100% me.
100% you. But you bring the life to the party, I'm sure. Speaking of your day job, when you're not doing this podcast and covering all things City of Cincinnati, big news this week.
Cincinnati is getting a new city manager, and while the vote is not final as we record this, I am not worried about this at all. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval, under the charter, he kind of gets to pick the city manager, council approves the person, and he put forward one of the assistant city managers, Cheryl Long, and she has been in Cincinnati, that role, for 2 years and really done a lot, like touched a lot of the different departments in her work. I have to say, there was a formal announcement of, you know, the nomination on Friday. There had to be at least 200 people there. I did not see that coming. It was so hot outside. I was like, I already know who it is. Should I actually go, you know, Friday afternoon, go to City Hall? I'm so glad I did. I saw everybody who was anybody really kind of came out, really spoke to the role of the city manager in this city and how that works. We, AFTAP Puroval is a superstar like our guest today, Jose Salazar. He just is. Like, people recognize him. But the city manager does so much in this city, and just the crowd, you know, people came from her family. They came from North College Hill where she worked before, and just
– And she was actually – this is not the first time she's been a city manager, because she was the
– City administrator, yeah.
The top administrator in North College Hill.
Yes.
And but that's not the same as running a city the size of Cincinnati. Do you think she's prepared?
Oh, nothing is.
Do you think anybody's actually prepared when they get their first big promotion?
Because
I know
not.
I was not. I'm as sure as I sit here, I was not. And the person who promoted me told me I wasn't. She's like, I was like, do you think I'm ready? And she's like, I know you're not ready, but you can't possibly be ready until you are in the spot.
You know, somebody-
so, and I think that's really true of taking a big leap into being the top administrator in the city the size of Cincinnati.
Somebody did say to me yesterday, because I've been describing this person as the CEO of the city, 6,000 employees, 17 departments, blah, blah, blah. And the person I was talking to about this yesterday, she put it this way to me, and it's so true. Who do you trust with everything? And it is the city manager. Is there a pandemic? The city manager is going to run that. Is there a health crisis? Is there a flood? Is there anything? Public safety? Is there a shooting on Main Street? The city manager answers the phone all day, at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so she, to me, really, we were framing the conversation of the city manager as that. And I really loved that, because this is true of that job. So no, I don't think you can ever be ready. I do want to tell people, before we get to our special guest, I interviewed her yesterday with Phil, came with me, and we had a quick 15-minute conversation. And a lot of times the Inquirer, you know, will kind of boil that down. I'll write a story. But what we decided to do is it's a 15-minute video clip. That's a long video clip. People's time is very valuable. But we're going to put that out there on Thursday, September 1st, on the day that she is to be voted on by council. And I want people to just understand who she is. And you can't do that, really. Her own voice is her own voice. And so I hope you guys watch it. And that's really why I'm putting it up like that, and not just like an edited, like she's making news kind of clip. This is a meet and greet.
Fantastic. You know, normally in my role, I would say, but Sherry, we have to chop it down into, you know, bite-sized pieces for our busy audience. But we're not going to do that this time.
Thank you. Because Phil would kill me.
Right.
You would walk out of the room and Phil would be like, you just created more work for me. But you know what? My boss is off. So Carl is not here this week. So it's kind of like, I could do whatever I want. Right, Phil? Did I not say that walking out of City Hall? I was like, you know, I feel like this would be great.
And I think there are occasions where raw is good. Like, we're not going to edit it down. We're not going to let our own, you know, judgments as far as what to take out, what to leave in, to get it down to, you know, the average, I think, video that people consume online is something like 12 seconds, you know? It's ridiculously small, especially, you know, if you think about TikTok and everything like that.
True.
So this is really truly going to be for the wonks out there, right? The
yes.
People that really want to get to know this person. My thought when I saw the announcement was, it reminded me a lot about when Patrick Duhaney became the city manager following, you know, a very tumultuous period in the city where the city manager was always in the news, sparring with the mayor. And while all this was happening, there are people quietly doing the work of the city, and Patrick Duhaney was one of them. And even when he became city manager, he was quiet, understated, you know, and now he's gone. Of course, he went to take the same role in Virginia Beach. I see her as kind of a similar, you know, not flashy, but probably effective and respected within the operation of the city.
I have definitely heard that. The one thing I think she said that surprised me the most is because she is like a quiet leader, at least behind the scenes. There's not controversy. Everyone seems to like her. And she described herself as loud, which obviously I relate to. Anyone in this newsroom say that I'm like super loud. And she's like, that's just how I am. And like, I just felt like that was like one of those get to know you moments, because that's not how I would have pictured. I mean, I talk to the city manager all the time, but I don't talk to the assistant city managers all the time.
Right.
And so it was interesting to hear her describe her own self and how she is.
So we will see now, because she'll be in the spotlight and she's got a big item on her to-do list now, and that's hire a police chief.
I know. And honestly, this is a meet and greet interview. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk to her more. She said that's her number. She did say at the announcement with the mayor, that's her number one priority. And you know what I liked? Like, is she just going to pick a police chief? And like, she already knows, right? Oh, do you know what the community wants? And da, da, da. And she said she's still going to talk to, because we've been talking about this all year long. And I feel like we do know what the community is looking for. And we do, you know, from our past chiefs, like what qualities we're looking for. But she still said that she wants to talk to the community and she's going to talk to the search firm and really like get her footing. But she wasn't like, we're going to pick a police chief. She's going to do some work into that. And I thought that was a really good answer.
That is a great answer. Well, more to come on that.
Yes.
Is it special guest time?
Definitely.
All right, let's do this.
Welcome to special guest time on That's So Cincinnati. I am so excited to talk about food with our guest today, Jose Salazar. And as usual, I don't know why I'm not doing this in person at the restaurant, but that's okay. Or restaurants, as the case might be. Welcome, Jose.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You know what? I reached out because I was reading about your new Columbia Tusculum bodega, Daylily, and I was mm-hmm. like, you haven't been a guest before. I eat at your restaurants all the time, and I was like, ooh, let's talk about food.
Thank you. We just opened, a little over a week ago. It's been kind of a wild ride. We were busier than expected because we didn't officially announce it yet, and of course with social media there's really no hiding anything anymore, so the word's out, the cat's out the bag. A little pun intended there, because you know cats are usually in bodegas, although we don't have one because we're trying to keep up with health regulations and I'm allergic, so no cats in our bodega.
So speaking of bodegas, unless you grew up in New York or visit New York, you might not even know what a bodega is. Can you explain what a bodega is for someone in Cincinnati that might be wondering?
True. Yeah, right. A bodega is essentially a store, your local like convenience store, corner store. But oftentimes they're run by Latin Americans. So the term bodega means store in Spanish. But they vary. I mean, it's sort of like, depending on the neighborhood, you're going to get a different type of bodega. So if you're in certain parts of Brooklyn, you might have some Caribbean flair to your bodega, where there's a big Caribbean population. If you go up to Harlem, you might have, a different vibe up there. And where I grew up in Queens, it was mostly, Dominicans and Mexicans and, so Central Americans and Caribbean, Spanish speaking Caribbean folks. So, you know, they vary a lot and they sort of become, you know, a part of the community and take on the life of the people that live there.
Is that your goal with Daylily Deli?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. So if you come into our store, we have the Columbia Tusculum neighborhood is a little mix of, you know, different folks. I actually live there. I live two blocks from the store. So it's kind of a little bit selfish of me to build it there because, I mean, honestly, I built it because there's nothing in my neighborhood that I can go and just get like a quick cup of coffee or sandwich or a gallon of milk, or toilet bowl cleaner. So basically, you know, we want to be that little convenience store that has everything. But yeah, so we have some folks that are, you know, maybe, making less than, you know, so different socioeconomic backgrounds, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And so, so we have a little mix of different ingredients and different things that are, you know, again, just available to a different, to all different populations.
So before we talk about Daily Deli and your restaurants, I think it would be good just to go back to the beginning, like the Jose Salazar story. You were born in Colombia, raised in New York City, trained as a chef, and ended up in Cincinnati. Can you tell us about what was the event, or how did you end up in Cincinnati?
Yeah, it was a little bit by accident. My son was born, and for the first 9 months or so, my wife and I basically never saw each other and rarely saw our son. And we were both native New Yorkers, essentially, and never really considered living somewhere else. But I had this epiphany one day. I just woke up and I was like, well, why don't we think about going somewhere else? You know what I mean? Like, people move all the time, right? You know, but I think when you grow up in New York, so there's something about, like, it's New York, right? And you don't think to leave. This was like at the height of the recession, late 2008. And I didn't really know where to go. I mean, everything was kind of like at a standstill, but I put out some resumes and wanted to stay on the East Coast, most likely. But I got a call from a headhunter and he told me about this job at a hotel where I would get to, you know, run the show, do my own food, all that stuff. And we had about a 30-minute conversation. And then at the end of it, he says, it's in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I said, well, I don't know anything about Cincinnati. I've never been. I actually didn't even really know where it was on the map, to be quite honest.
And for those who don't know, you're talking about the former Palace at the...
Palace Restaurant in the Cincinnati Hotel is where I ended up going. And so, you know, I came, I did a tasting, fell in love with the city, really fell in love with the architecture and just the vibe of it and the pace. And I felt like it was what we needed at the time, you know, coming, being New Yorkers. I thought this was going to be a really nice change of pace, and it ended up, you know, being all those things. And you know, we raised our son. He's 14 now, so we've raised our son in Cincinnati, and it's been a really great experience.
I have a 14-year-old. Burl's son is 15.
16.
Oh, Burl.
Yeah, I know. Just get ready, Jose. It's coming.
Yeah.
It hasn't started.
We're on the bubble. Like, some days I have my little boy. Some days I have a teenager. It just depends on the day.
I can totally relate. I know the feeling.
So did you find the food community here welcoming to you?
Yeah, I did, really. I met John Robert shortly after I got here, and he embraced me quite a bit. He also moved here from New York, obviously from France originally, but he and I had some similarities. And, you know, he was working at some high end restaurants in New York and sort of came to Cincinnati by accident a little bit. So he sort of took me under his wing a little bit and showed me around and introduced me to folks.
So after a few years at the Palace, you decided it was time to open your own place and even put your name on the restaurant. Was that in the playbook when you came to Cincinnati, or when you came here, did you decide that there was an opportunity? What was going on in your mind?
It wasn't in the playbook at all. Basically, my plan when I moved here was 3 to 4 years and then probably head back east somewhere, but not necessarily New York. I think we were thinking maybe Philadelphia. We have some friends there and we always liked that city. And it was, again, a little smaller, kind of not quite as hectic as New York. But yeah, I mean, in those 4 years leading up to the opening of Salazar, obviously I got to know more people. Obviously the transformation of Over the Rhine was happening. And, you know, that's when I really started thinking, okay, maybe maybe we just stay here. Maybe we just kind of build a life here. And started talking to 3CDC and got the ball rolling on that.
And you, at that point, you're the chef in your kitchen, right? And you're there every day. And
When I opened Salazar, yes. You mean?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I was there. I think for the first year, I think I was there every day, all day. Didn't take any days off, really.
How did Midas come about? So then, I mean, you have an empire now, I think we should say, although I said at the beginning of the podcast, but I mean, there's a lot going on now. It's not just one place to be in a kitchen.
It's quite a bit going on. I don't know if I could quite consider it an empire, but, you know, definitely I'm busy. I keep myself busy. I kind of don't like to rest on my laurels. I'm somebody that just always feels like, okay, what's next, you know? I think if you know me, I'm constantly moving. I'm sort of a little bit of a go kind of guy. But Mita's kind of another sort of accident. So I was talking to 3CDC shortly after we opened Salazar, and I had this idea to do another sort of very New York type of concept, which is like a Latin American lunch counter. It's basically a steam table. That holds different, you know, braised meats and rice and beans, very sort of like a Puerto Rican, Dominican, concept where it's, you know, kind of like Chipotle style, fast casual. You walk down, you say, I'm going to have, you know, the plantains with the yellow rice, the beans and the roast pork. And then, you know, you get it in your sort of, lunch tray or in your packed up in your to-go box. And so I thought one of those like shotgun spaces on Vine would work really well for that space.
I wouldn't call Mita's a shotgun space. That's a beautiful space.
Yeah. Well, so I'm about to get into how Mita's came about. So they said, well, that sounds great. You know, let's explore that. And then next thing you know, they're saying, well, we're building this 8451 building, and you know, would you consider going there? And they originally were showing me the space on 6th Street, Race. So where Medici was, where the pizza place was. And so as soon as I walked in there, I said, well, I don't think that concept's going to work for this. and so I had to kind of rethink so for me, a lot of times it's, you know, going into a space and thinking what fits here and not necessarily having a concept in mind and trying to find the right location for it. Although in the case of the fast casual Puerto Rican spot, that's, you know, what I thought. I thought, okay, a shotgun space. Anyhow, so, then, you know, we ended up going to the other side of the building, on 5th and Race, and then, which was even a larger space, and it kind of just made sense to make it into a kind of fun, big, vibrant tapas joint.
So of all your places, that is my favorite one just because I like the vibe. I like the small plates. If you're Greek, you call it meze, and there's a lot of similarities in, you know, that kind of Mediterranean type of food and presentation, you know, the grilled octopus and things like that, that you really, when you first opened Mita's, I don't think you could find that type of a place. Were you worried that Cincinnatians wouldn't connect with it like they did?
You know, I was a little bit. But I also had faith in Cincinnatians. They're pretty adventurous, I think, more than a lot of people would give them credit for. And you know, I think they're kind of hungry for unique stuff. Some folks might not give them enough credit, you know? And so I think for a little bit, you might have seen a lot of things popping up that were very similar because it was safe, because it was a proven, you know, concept that tried and true. And, you know, you were secure in that that's going to work. But, you know, I like to think that setting yourself apart and doing something a little unique is also another way of attracting people too.
So in terms of the growth of your businesses and how you approach things as an entrepreneur, do you have a plan as far as how many different spots, and are you shifting to becoming more of an entrepreneur than a chef? You hear of chefs that have a fantastic restaurant, and it's happened in this town too, where growth happens too rapidly to manage quality and the experience. Are you in that spot now where you are trying to decide how big and where your emphasis is going to be? Is it going to be in the kitchen? Is it going to be on the, you know, the more business side, the entrepreneurial side?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it certainly becomes harder to manage quality and consistency when you have more things. But I think one of the most important things is having people who can help me. Any business owner, I think, will tell you that you're only as good as the folks that work with you. And so I am fortunate that I have really, really good people in not just my management roles, but the staff in general. I think we are supremely fortunate to have wonderful, wonderful people working with us. And so I guess the other part of your question was like, do I have a plan to every time I open something, I go, this is it. This is the last one. Never again.
Have you hit that spot now with the deli?
Yeah.
Have you hit that spot now with the deli where you're like, okay, I've got,
I mean, if when you ask me this week, yeah, because I'm exhausted and I'm, you know, working 90-hour weeks. So of course right now, but you know, it's, I think it's like anything. Like people might say that when they have a child or something, they go, oh my God, that was so hard. I'll never do it again. And then of course you love your child and you think, well, maybe if I had another one of those, you know, that would be really cool, wouldn't it? And so you kind of forget that there's so much pain and effort and heartache that goes into all of that. I mean, I guess heartache isn't maybe the right word, especially from relating it to childbirth, but you know, it's difficult. It's hard. But at the same time, it's fun and it's the creative process is probably what I enjoy the most, you know, kind of seeing something come to life that you maybe started jotting down ideas or sketching on a napkin. It's kind of crazy and surreal when it happens and you open the doors and you're like, holy, can I curse? Holy
you can.
Shit.
Yeah, totally.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We're adults
so,
here.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. So I think the design aspect is probably what I enjoy the most, and the organization and conceptualization of something, and getting it, you know, giving it life, getting it up and running. The day-to-day operations, that's probably the toughest part, but again, I still enjoy it. I love what I do. And, so will I do more? Probably. Do I have a plan to do more today? No concrete plans. My focus would be on making sure that the ones that I currently have stay, you know, stay good, that they continue to thrive and that people continue to enjoy them, because, you know, I have this like overwhelming fear of letting people down who come to eat at our restaurants. You know, I feel like, of course we can't be perfect, but I have this sense of responsibility to try to give you the best experience we can. And if we fall short, then to try to make it up to you somehow and say, you know, to let you know that we really, really care. And so that's something we instill, in all our restaurants, we try to let our management know that that's supremely important.
I mean, I think too that you're talking about that you have all these people around you helping you, but I mean, one of the standout things for me that you did was during COVID, and it seemed like everything was really coming out of Mita's. You had the big space to help all of the restaurant workers, and you really didn't just say, well, my restaurant's going to be closed, it's COVID. that you seemed to mobilize with others, I know, but it seemed really to be emanating from what you were doing to help all of our restaurant workers. What was that like?
Well, it's a very, you know, gratifying experience. Obviously, it was a crazy time, and you know, there's something instinctually that just, you know, as a chef, you say we need to feed people, we need to nourish them and give them the essentials. And so I think that just sort of comes naturally. We had the space. We partnered with the Lee Initiative, Chef Edward Lee out of Louisville, and he was great. And we had help from many, many folks. But, you know, Susie DeYoung at La Soupe also was very instrumental. And so, you know, it was just, we all rallied together. I feel like people were so, I guess, I don't know, the response was overwhelming in terms of like people thanking us. And I was like, well, why wouldn't we? You know what I mean? Like it didn't seem like something that I needed to be thanked for, but I'm just glad we had the opportunity to do it.
You also mentioned that the secret of your success, and especially with managing multiple locations, is having good people around you and creating that culture. Can you talk about how hard that has been to maintain as we come out of the pandemic? Particularly, I think restaurants and other service type industries have been challenged with finding people to work, finding people that are, you know, committed to the areas of service and quality. Have you had trouble maintaining staffing levels?
Yeah, of course. It's an industry-wide problem. But, you know, again, I think we are fortunate, and we have lots of folks that have been with us for a long time. We instill a culture of respect and camaraderie. And so I think by virtue of that, we have people who work with us who then say to others, hey, you might want to come check this place out and think it's a good fit, you know? But yeah, of course we've had many challenges. We still do, you know, it feels like we're always just like a little bit understaffed at all our restaurants. Like if we could use one more person here, and then, you know, suddenly somebody goes out with COVID or, you know, quits or whatever. I mean, it's definitely, there's a shortage of people in our industry, but you know, I think there's an ebb and flow. I think eventually we'll get over that hump too.
So as somebody who has really started coming back into the office, there is just not a lot of things open for lunch yet downtown. It really does feel like it's tough to find places. Do you feel like that's like a staffing issue?
Probably to some degree. Yeah, I know a lot of people in our industry who have cut back their hours. We've had to do it on occasion as well. Cut back their hours or the days that they operate. So I would not be surprised if that was the case. And then of course, you know, it's a supply and demand business, right? So maybe you guys are back in the office, but maybe there's just not enough people overall back in the offices to sustain, you know, being open for that whole shift.
Some days I feel like there's a lot of people downtown, and some days I'm like, no, it's still COVID. I don't think it's consistent at all.
Yeah, and inconsistency is really hard in our business because, you know, you kind of have to expect to be busy every day. So you have to staff accordingly. And of course, if you don't, and then you get busy, then you're dropping the ball and you're letting people down, and they're getting a bad product or they're having to wait a long time. And so it's a real kind of catch 22. Do you know how many people do you staff? And then what days? And then again, so if it's like you said, it might be Tuesday, there's not a lot of people, but Wednesday, all of a sudden there's a lot of people, and you just basically have to be prepared for anything.
So we did want to, you know, we were doing some research, which depends on the week on how much preparation we do for the podcast.
We always prepare for this podcast.
Totally. Sorry. Yeah. And, you know, I came across a story. Sometimes I do think it's enough that I just eat at all the restaurants, and that's the great preparation right there. But we did come across a story where you talked a little bit about your sobriety journey, and that surprised me. I mean, I go to your restaurants, I might drink some wine. And, you know, that's just notorious in the restaurant industry that there's just a lot, there's alcohol around a lot. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm coming up on 4 years of sobriety. October 20th is my soberversary. And, you know, it sort of happened by accident in that I was about to open Goose and Elder. And I just knew that it was going to be very demanding, and that I was going to be working a ton of hours. So I said, I'm going to take a little break. This was in October, and I figured I'll probably, you know, stop until like around the holidays, like Christmas. And about a month in, I was feeling really good and really energetic. And I said, well, maybe even beyond Christmas, but I said, I'll wait. And Christmas rolled around and I decided I didn't want to drink. And then January and so on. And like, it wasn't like an intentional, like, I'm going to quit today and I'll never drink again. But then that day did come. There was, I don't know exactly when, but it was a few months afterwards where I just said, you know what? I don't miss it. I feel a lot better. I feel healthier. And I started to also accept that I had, that I needed to not drink. It was beyond just, you know, me telling myself that I wanted to be healthier and have more energy. But, while I didn't drink every day, I certainly, did abuse alcohol and had moments where, I drank in excess, way more than I should have. And just, you know, decided that it was something that I didn't need in my life anymore.
So one of the things,
I gave it up all together.
One of the things you said in that article, and we'll give credit to Spectrum News, who wrote that piece, you shared something that I thought was very common among people who are in recovery for any kind of, whether it's drugs or alcohol, that if you walk up to someone and say, oh, I'm going to lose weight, they say, that's great. That's fantastic. They understand that. If you tell somebody that, you know, I'm going to quit smoking, same thing. Great. You know, awesome. If you tell somebody, you know what, I'm just not drinking anymore, it's not the same. You get question, well, like, why, you know, why would you do that? Can you share a little bit about those experiences and did that make it more challenging? Did that give you more resolve? Because I thought that was a very, common experience that people have when they decide that they want to quit.
Yeah, you're right. I kind of forgot that I mentioned that I said that, but you know, it's true. It's almost like a sign of weakness when you say, when in fact, I think it takes a lot of strength to stand up and say, you know what? I'm not going to do this thing that's harming me anymore. And yeah, if you relate it to, obesity or, you know, smoking or whatever, even if you're not obese and you only smoke an occasional cigarette, if you say you want to get healthier, people usually are going to congratulate you for that. But somehow when it comes to alcohol, it's sort of like you've failed and you aren't strong enough to curtail yourself and to just drink in moderation, which for some people just isn't a reality. Some people just can't do that. And so, you know, I don't know, society, I think, looks at alcohol, a lot differently than they do some other vices. And, I think when we start to normalize recovery, and understand that it's a disease and that it's a problem for people, then maybe people will be a little bit more understanding. But, you know, for now, it does, and it is challenging. And did it give me resolve? Yeah, it did too, though, because it just said, well, screw you. You know, I don't really care what you think. I'm going to do what I think is best for me.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us, because I think that, to your point, the way our society, you know, judges certain medical situations, you know, and that you know, what you said about it being, you know, some people for their health need to quit. I think sharing your story will not just give people that same resolve, but might make other people watch, you know, what they say and how they react and be more supportive, because I think that, you know, the only way for that to happen is for people to be brave enough to talk about it openly. So I respect you a lot for sharing that part of your experience.
Yeah. It certainly is frustrating. You know, someone's like, come on, just have one drink. And it's like, would you say, with that person trying to lose weight, we say, come on, just one more cupcake.
Right.
Come on. What's the big deal?
You're absolutely
no,
right.
You would never do that. It's kind of rude and inconsiderate. And so I do hope that maybe some people rethink the way they talk to people who are saying they're in recovery or trying to recover, abstain, or even just cut down. It's like, you know, it's a decision that I think should be respected.
I will say, I do know other people who have made this decision in their life. And like, a common thing is to take, sources, you go out for drink after work and you talk about things. And that's a very important part of reporting, is talking about things. Mm-hmm. But I just do a lot more walks now. I'm cognizant of like what people want to do. I don't want to drink after work every day. And, you know, I've just really, I think this is becoming more common, and I hope that that people begin to understand more of what you're saying, because I do cognizantly say, well, I know who's not drinking, and I'm like, well, let's go for a walk. You can only drink so much coffee in the day, and I don't want to drink coffee like afternoon ever. And so you can go for a walk and do other things and still have all the same conversation and all the same amount of fun. You're just doing something different.
Well, I think the other thing is to cut down on the stigma and to, you know, to say, well, we can go out, but we can have non-alcoholic beverages, you know, and if for some people that's being in a bar setting is not ideal, but there's many people who don't drink alcohol and are fine going to a restaurant or a bar. And there's a lot more options for them now, non-alcoholic options, but also not, I guess, how do I put it? So if everyone's kind of like the elephant in the room, and you're like, oh, I shouldn't even mention alcohol around this person, or I shouldn't have a drink myself, I think most people who are abstaining are okay with others drinking, others talking about alcohol. Again, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think sort of treating it as if you're, you know what I mean? It's like just letting that person just be and not making them feel like an outcast, I think helps and goes a long way. Just treating them like a normal person,
right,
who just so happens they don't drink, yeah, and that's fine. You know what I mean? Like
normalizing it.
Normalize sobriety. Normalize the fact that some people just aren't going to consume alcohol. It's I guess, another way, if we want to make analogies, is, you know, if there's a vegetarian at the table, right, you don't make a big deal about it. You don't say, oh, let's not eat meat around Tiffany because she's a vegetarian. Like, Tiffany knows that you eat meat, and she's likely okay with it, you know. And if she's not, she'll let you know, like, hey, I can't even stand to look at you eating that steak. But generally speaking, right, most vegetarians you go out with, they're like, okay, you eat the meat and I'll eat the vegetables. And that's, I think, for most people who are abstaining from alcohol, that's kind of the state that they're in. They're just like, just treat me like a normal person, dude. Don't make a big deal about it.
Well, let's hope people are listening to that.
Yeah.
Now, to shift gears, I like to call this the fast break section because obviously we could interview you all day. Everything you say, I think of like 10 follow-up questions, but we got to rein it in at some point. Right. But you mentioned that Jean Robert, was one of the people that reached out that you connected with earlier. I would say right now there's probably less than 4 chefs that are household names in town. Jean Robert, obviously, but you're another one, Jose Salazar. People, you know, you have reached that level of, you know, celebrity chef status in town.
Okay.
Oh, you know, don't
definitely
act surprised.
That's okay.
Did you anticipate that was going to happen? Not that that's like what was driving you, but are you aware, or when did you become aware that you had reached that sort of level in Cincinnati's culinary scene?
Oh, I don't know. I don't really think about that stuff. I do my job and I try to make people happy, and that's all that matters. The whatever status you want to attach to me, whether the word celebrity or whatever, I don't care about none of that stuff. That doesn't matter.
Okay. So you said you work 90 hours a week, which I'm guessing does not leave you a lot of time to go out to eat. But if you go out to eat and you go to somebody else's restaurant, where do you go?
Oh, right now I love my friend Jeff Harris's restaurant, Nolia. It's in the old Please space in Over the Rhine.
Oh, I've heard about this restaurant.
He's doing amazing stuff. So I would say definitely go check him out. It's kind of New Orleans. He's from New Orleans originally. He came up. He actually worked with me at the Palace way back in the early days. He came up after Katrina, and another guy who thought he'd only be here for a little bit, you know, thought maybe a year or two and then go back after they, you know, fixed his home and all that, and ended up staying. And he's doing a wonderful sort of mix of New Orleans and different Southern influences. So definitely go check him out. Nolia is the name, N-O-L-I-A.
You know, now he's going to have too many customers to keep up with, thanks to your endorsement.
All right, I think that's a good problem to have in our industry. We're happy to see people coming back out to eat, and we definitely we're hungry for folks to come back out. We need all the support and love we can get still. And COVID is not over, and we still have lots and lots of challenges in our industry. And so the more the merrier. Please come out and eat.
What's your biggest pet peeve when you go to a restaurant?
Pet peeve? I don't know. I'm actually really easygoing when I go out to a restaurant. I try not to, not even that I try. I don't judge. I kind of just go with the flow. I'm out to relax. I don't, you know, so many restaurateurs or chefs are like sit there and criticize things or judge all the little details. And me, I just want to relax. I'm typically, you know, it's again, far and few between when I get to go out. So if I'm out, I'm just trying to enjoy myself and my company, and you know, hopefully it's a good meal, and if it's not, again, it's at least I'm not the one cooking, and I get to sit down and not be stressed out about anything.
Is your son an adventurous eater? Because no, when you said the word Chipotle, that might be a food group for my son.
He's not. He's a healthy eater. He likes vegetables and salads, and you know, he's good about eating a nice mix of foods, but not adventurous, and there's certain, you know, he has his limited pantry that he goes to, and that's it. But he's getting better. He's getting better all the time. He told me that every 7 years your palate changes, which I didn't know that, but this is
definitely learned that in health class.
Fact. And so now that he's 14, he's like, I'm trying new things, Dad. And so he has been, but doesn't mean he actually enjoys them or continues to, you know, he'll try them, and that's about as far as he goes usually. But he's getting better. And you know what? As long as he's happy and healthy. I don't care. But, you know, I wish he tried more? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Your answers have been very diplomatic, but I want you to not be diplomatic with the answer to this next question. Okay. All right. Ready? Cincinnati style chili, yay or nay?
Oh, man. It's hard. You got to put me in that position.
It's hard. Okay.
So look, I don't hate it because, because, you know, it's a staple, right? But it's just not the style of chili that I grew up eating was the chunky, full of beans, you know, I guess Texas style chili. That's what I grew up with. That's what I love.
Fair enough.
So no, it's not my favorite. But on a Coney, I think it's good. I like the Coneys.
So what about Geta? So it took me a while.
Geta.
You love Geta.
I actually had a Geta sandwich this morning at Daylily. You know, we have Geta. We do an egg and cheese on a roll for breakfast, and you can add bacon or ham, which is a very New York bodega type thing. You get egg and cheese on a roll, and we of course had to add Geta into the mix because we're in Cincinnati, and I love it. I love Geta. It's we get it from Eckerland Meats, which to me, in my opinion, is the best Geta in town. It's got lots of black pepper in it, and gets nice and crispy. So Geta definitely two thumbs up.
All the Gleers folks are now just up in arms.
They're lovely. They've been on the podcast before.
I'm going to get in trouble no matter what.
No, we don't want to get you in trouble.
How about this? All Geta is good. My personal favorite is Eckerland.
To be fair, that's actually true. I was not a Geta person until I was pregnant. And I was pregnant. It was Mother's Day.
Talk about events that change your palate.
And my husband was like, what do you want to do for Mother's Day? And I was like, I think I need some Geta. And he's like, who are you even? And now I love Geta.
Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, so there's Scrapple on the East Coast. You guys ever heard of Scrapple?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
It's so I was familiar with something that was very similar to Geta growing up. And so switching over and, you know, being introduced to Geta was an easy thing. And I didn't have to acquire a taste for it. I already had it.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you get back to your 90-hour work week. Thank you so much for coming on. This was a great conversation about food in Cincinnati, and I'm super excited to come out to Daylily. And now I'll have to come for breakfast.
Yeah, 3751 Eastern Avenue in Columbia, Tuscaloosa.
What time?
Come on down.
What are your hours?
We're open 7 days a week, 7 to 7, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Kitchen closes at 6. We've got beer and wine and all kinds of groceries and goodies. We're also, our grand opening is this Saturday, so we'll have lots of specials. We've got dollar hot dogs, Chevrolet, and dollar coffee in the morning. And we're going to have some beer specials and all kinds of goodies. So come on down.
Well, as usual, I could talk to our special guest all day long, but if I'm going to get to Daylily for lunch, we have to wrap up.
Yeah, really. We should all go there on Saturday for the grand opening.
So
dollar hot dogs. Is that what he said?
Yes, and that is one of the foods that my son does eat, so that'll be perfect. It's time for our That's So Cincinnati moment.
I've got one. I came
prepared
this time.
Tough to pick this week. Tough to pick.
Oh, no. No. I thought of this immediately because this is not just a Cincinnati moment, but what appears to be the end of what for many is a very Cincinnati moment, and that's going to Sharon Woods and driving through the holiday lights display, which is a holiday tradition for many families going back 30 years. And we learned this week that Great Parks, which is Hamilton County's park system, is not renewing the agreement with the group that staged this light show, saying that they're going to shift their energies elsewhere. And this did not go well, sit well with many people. In fact, there's a petition, online petition started to kind of you know, ask them to change their minds and reconsider. I think it's a gutsy move on the park boards or the parks, you know, Great Parks system leadership to just sort of end that tradition.
I'm of two minds on this. So kudos to Great Parks for explaining themselves, because too many times that we hear, oh, this is da-da-da, and just like you don't really get a good explanation. And they really – they explained themselves and they said that we really want to get more to the core mission of parks, which is activity, moving, and doing. And so they are planning this whole new holiday experience, and I have no doubt it will be amazing.
I think it'll be fantastic. They're shifting it to Winton Woods, and they said, you know, it would be very tough for them to have competing holiday events at their parks. However
– a family full – of people, including our grandparents. And like that is a place where you can put a child and a grandparent in a car together to experience something. Not everyone can be active.
Yeah. And I'm not in the weeds with all of this. This is just how I reacted to it. You know, like you, I understand, you know, change has to happen and we all have to deal with it. And I'm pretty aggressive in how we handle change at the Enquirer. I mean, we have had to adapt to changes in technology, reader habits, everything, the just total, you know, upending of our business model. So I get it. But let me share a personal experience here, okay? When I came back to the Enquirer in 2018, one of the first questions that I was asked by some staff members was, can we finally kill the dress the turkey contest? Oh, Burl, it's so much work. All these entries come in and, you know, some come in the mail and people have trouble uploading and we got to go through them all and scan them in and, you know, budget the space to, you know, run them in the paper. And it's just so much work. And I said, look, there are some things that I will be, you know, that, you know, there's very few sacred cows in my mind, but I will not be the editor in chief that kills the dress the turkey contest. I won't do that. I won't do that to the city. I won't do that to all the third grade, you know, teachers that have it as a class art project and mail it in to us.
Jack has brought home more than one turkey.
Oh my gosh. I will not be that guy, even though, yes, it's a lot of work on our part. And does it really match, you know, our core mission to, you know, be the eyes and ears of our community and emphasize high impact journalism and accountability and First Amendment? Does it do any of that? Hell no.
It is a moment in pop culture, but I love the ones that are like the moment.
And so I compare it to that. You know, I can't believe that, you know, this current leadership of our park system is the one to end the Sharon Lights holiday display. And again, you brought up a good point. They explain themselves. We all get things have to change. But I just want to go on the record of saying that we've lost a moment now. If there's no, you know, big holiday lights display where you're driving through a beautiful, you know, wooded area.
We do still have Coney Island, I think.
Got Coney Island. It's not the same.
The traffic.
I know, right? I know.
Wow, I sound really old.
So, okay, rant over. You know, I'm sure
this
I'm going to get.
This is so Cincinnati of us. Yeah. We're veering more into that so Cincinnati as right? we go along in this conversation.
Oh, I know. Okay, so anyway, I'll try to be not so negative next week. I promise, because people don't want to hear that, or maybe they do.
Don't forget to send us questions that you want us to answer at our Twitter feeds at Sharon Coolidge and at Burl Love. Thank you for listening. I suspect we went long today. I'm not even looking at Phil at this point.
Producer Phil is taking a nap right now. Like, wake me up when you guys are done. But
it's the best kind of podcast. We just kind of talk about all the things. Thanks for listening, you guys.